The Hamians are struggling to get to Florida. One group is trying to solve the affordable housing crisis in Miami. And a play about a girl who wants to play baseball. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The death toll is rising in the Bahamas. Thousands are seeking help, and many are trying to get out and get to Florida. We'll get an update from parts of the Bahamas. And a research group from FIU wants to hear from you about the best way to deal with the lack of affordable housing in South Florida. Why do millions of funds designated for affordable housing in the region remain unspent? Finally, there's a play coming to Homestead. It's based on one of the short stories from the popular book, In Cuba, I Was a German Shepherd. It's by Cuban-American author Ana Menendez. We'll meet the two actors. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, no one can tell how long it's going to take to rebuild the Abaco and Grand Bahama Islands, and we don't know if those areas will ever return to what they once were. Currently, authorities are searching for bodies still doing recovery, and thousands of people are looking for relief. Many are trying to get to Florida to be with friends and family. We're joined now by WLRN reporter Danny Rivero and America's correspondent Tim Padgett, who went to parts of the Bahamas to see how those efforts are going, and they join me now. Gentlemen, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Both of you went separately, but you were there over the weekend, parts of the weekend. Mm-hmm. Tim, real quickly, first of all, the only way to get there right now is, to get to islands right. is by boat.
Pretty much, yeah. Right, or by helicopter.
So both of you were in Freeport, though?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about what you saw when you got there. Tim, what was, the atmosphere at that time?
Well, I think a lot of the images that people are seeing now from the Bahamas are from Abaco because those are so devastating. And that's where both the wind and the storm surge just essentially wiped out whole towns like Marsh Harbor. On Grand Bahama, the impression I got was that the wind was terrible, but not as terrible as it was on Abaco. What was terrible on Grand Bahama was the storm surge. It came roaring in. Because of the spin of the cyclone, the storm surge, about 20 feet, came roaring in from the north, and it really, really hit the neighborhoods to the north of the coast of Grand Bahama, the northern part of Freeport, very, very hard. And that's where you saw the worst devastation. It reminded me of the houses I saw, for example, in the Ninth Ward of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina flooded that whole area in 2005. You didn't see roofs blow off, but you could see where the water line was, almost reaching the ceiling before the storm surge subsided. And that can do almost as much damage to a home mm-hmm. as the winds would.
And for you, Danny, what were some of the first impressions of when you got there? I mean, you'd already seen so many videos and photos, but what did you see?
Well, Tim and I were on different ships, and the ship I was on a smaller ship that was able to dock right on the port. We didn't have to take a smaller vessel to reach the land. And so right from when we kind of docked before we even got off the boat, you could look over the edge and you could see lines of people lined up to do we didn't know what when we were on the boat. But there was lots of people out there already by the time we got there. And then once you walked off the ship, the scene at the harbor, there was thousands of people that got out there. Some people as early as 3 a.m, somebody told me to wait to try to board the ship that I was on, which was a Bahamian Paradise cruise line ship, which came there with some Bahamians that were stuck during the storm here in Florida, and they were wanting to return to check on their properties and family. But on the return trip, they were going to bring about 1,500 people off the island. So there was lines starting at 3 a.m. to get on this ship that left at midnight. And once the heat of the day started to come out, the scene at the port was, people were, they were in a panic almost. There was people saying, I spent screaming at each other. I spent 30 hours on a roof, my home is done. I need to get to Florida. I have family in Florida. And people were really, there was thousands of people. There's 1,500 seats and people were
it was
desperate.
Chaotic. It was chaotic.
Yeah.
It really was.
Just that idea, right now, where are people sleeping and how are they getting food?
Well, on Grand Bahama, as I said, you didn't see a lot of the roofs torn off that you were seeing in Abaco, for example. A lot of people are still able to sleep in their homes. But there's no power, yeah. There's no food, there's no water. About the only thing they do have left is maybe a roof on their homes, but even staying inside those homes is not really safe. You know?
And I'll mention, I mean, there. I did go into some neighborhoods and see many homes without roofs as well.
Yeah.
So, but the floods mm-hmm. were really what
more
damaged
more
it.
To the east on Grand Bahama is where you saw the wind damage. But you know, as you get further to the west, it was more water damage.
But
just as horrific.
Do they have tend to see after a hurricane? FEMA would come in, for example, and set up some kind of like tent city or something. But do they have anything set up stationed where people can go to at least get some basic supplies or medical help or anything like that?
Just a few sort of ad hoc food and water distribution points, but you're not seeing anything sort of like, you know, the FEMA mobilization that you would expect to see after a hurricane here. The thing that struck me and Danny most, I think, was that we saw very little Bahamian government presence in these neighborhoods. You would have expected maybe to see soldiers, you know, something the equivalent of a National Guard in the Bahamas, out there in the neighborhoods, at least patrolling, trying to help residents however they could. Unfortunately, you just didn't see much of that at all. No presence of utility trucks. None of the stuff that we take for granted seeing after a major storm like that here, for example. And you just have to resign yourself to the fact that you know, the Bahamian government is getting hammered PR-wise for this, but the reality is it doesn't have the resources to push out that kind of personnel and equipment after a storm like this. Nothing could have prepared many large cities in the U.S. for this storm. So imagine the Bahamas.
Yeah, and I'll just to add to that, I mean, for context, the main police department, the main police department office in Freeport was flooded,
mm-hmm.
and the majority of their vehicles were lost in that flood, and they're not usable anymore. So even as a matter of, you know, getting the police vehicles and getting people into trucks and you know, vehicles to get people out into neighborhoods, most of that is gone. I mean, they're having to try kind of commandeer vehicles if they can to get them out if they are out. But you don't see, like Tim mentioned, much Bahamian presence at all. You see a lot of U.S. presence, actually, because they're flying helicopters all day.
Coast Guard.
But the problem is that U.S. presence is running up against the lack of Bahamian presence. While we were there, a U.S. Coast Guard helicopter came into Freeport wanting to put some patients from Abaco into the Rand Memorial Hospital there on Grand Bahama. They were told, you can't because we're just as gutted as any other institution on the island.
Did you ever not feel safe?
No, I didn't feel unsafe. And I have to admit that, and maybe it's the residents themselves who had done this, but the streets were fairly clear of debris. I don't know if that was...
Completely, yeah. I was actually
that was impressive. Yeah.
You know what, Danny, you got the chance to speak with a gentleman named Edward Russell. He was one of the people who was waiting in line, again, to get on this. There was the cruise ship that was taking people back, bringing people back to Florida.
Exactly.
They had brought some folks and some supplies, but they were bringing people back. He has family, he said, in Ohio, and he's trying to get to them. Here's a little bit of what
he said. I have family in America, so they want me to come over though. And they're going to help me hopefully find work because it's kind of hard to live over here after this. So I'm just trying to start over. At least until, I don't know if it's going to be permanent, but we're going to go over there, make some money, at least until they bring this place back up, you know, and then hopefully we can come back over here and start over here again.
How common is that story that I got to get out, come here, trying to rebuild my life, maybe go back later?
So I did hear that from a lot of people, and there's kind of a continuum of things that I heard from people. It ranged from, you know, I'm going to go back and start over, start a whole new life, hopefully just new beginnings, new life completely in Florida, to people that were saying, look, I'm going to go to, our government's not doing anything, so I'm going to go to Florida for a couple of days.
And they were saying Florida specifically.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, something, I was doing the math and looking at it on the map. I mean, the distance between West Palm Beach and Grand Bahama is twice as close as the distance from Grand Bahama and Freeport to Nassau. So really, when people normally do like just purchasing runs, They go to West Palm Beach. They go to Fort Lauderdale. I mean, some of the people I met on the boat going over there that were stuck in Florida during the storm, they were just going to Florida to do, you know, back to school buying. So this is like a normal trip that people take. So I heard from some people, I'm going to go do some buying. I'm going to get the supplies because we're not getting it from the government. Then I'm going to come back. And then other people said, look, my home is gone. My job is gone. My family's homes were destroyed. I'm just going to see if I can start over.
Did you ever get the sense of people, I mean, how many people talk about wanting to come back or even stay and rebuild?
I did. I mean, I talked to one man, Sterling Albury, his home was completely decimated. I mean, he had a whole side of his house that was just wide open. Basically nothing left in the house. It was completely flooded, all the way up to the attic on a second floor. And he said, I mean, I'm not going to go anywhere. I'm going to try to find higher ground and see if I can rebuild.
One woman I talked to, she's going to Pembroke Pines to live with an uncle for a while. And I said, well, are you ever coming back to the Bahamas then? She said, yeah, I'll come back. I said, to Grand Bahamas? She says, no, Cat Island. I said, why Cat Island? It's the highest elevation in the Bahamas, she said.
Wow. And you, Tim, you got to talk to a number of different people. One of them was a Claudina Swan.
Yes.
A single Bahamian mother in Freeport. Tell us a little bit about her story.
Well, she has about five kids, but she has two that are about 5 years old, one's 2 years old. And she was in her house with them when that storm surge that I was talking about before swept into her neighborhood of Freeport, which is called Hudson Estate. And it swept in with a fury. And within seconds, she said, the water was rising up to her ceiling. She had no choice, as she said, to get up on the roof with her two kids sort of clinging to her neck. And I think we have a clip here of her telling me about
this
that.
This is her describing that experience.
And I had no other choice but to go on top of the roof with my kids on my neck. But that water, the surge was too strong, almost over my head. I looked down, I was like, no, Lord, please help us, because we go down, if that's it, we dead. Everybody.
You get the sense that she's still suffering. I mean, I can only imagine for a while. A lot of people are going to be suffering from the trauma of living through it.
Oh, yeah. That woman's a hero because she found a way, and it's a little bit of a miracle that happened that got her and the kids up onto that roof. And it's we'll be talking about that in our Latin America report tomorrow.
Again, we're talking about the recovery in the Bahamas. We're talking with WLRN's America's correspondent Tim Padgett and WLRN reporter Danny Rivero, both in Grand Bahama recently. And if you have family, by the way, friends, property, anything, we want to hear your stories. What's been happening with you? And if you just got here, you know, what is your plan? What do you want to do? Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Tell us about your story. Share with us. Look us up at WLRN Sundial. Danny, again, you were, and the story aired this morning, you were basically at the port where all these people, again, waiting to get on the boat, wanting to get out of the Bahamas, and it just sounded chaotic. Thousands of people. And again, you're telling me not a lot of authorities around. It sounded chaotic.
It really was chaotic. There was different estimates about how many people were out there. The highest I saw from anyone was as many as 5,000 people total, which if you consider the island of Grand Bahama has 50,000 people, that would be 10% of the population trying to get to the port and possibly get a boat off the island. Like we mentioned, there's zero electricity. There's not fresh water out of the tap. A lot of people's, even people that have pump wells, which a lot of people have there, it's been contaminated, so it's only really good for bathing. You can't really drink it. It was, there was very little order. You know, the authorities over and over again tried to impose, like, this is this line, this is this line, this is this line. Well, everyone's rushing it. Everyone was, I need to get on that boat and just doing it like that.
You talked to an Amanda Kilowan. Kilowan, I believe it is. Yes. Tell me a little bit about who she is.
So Amanda is actually an immigrant from Suriname. She moved to Grand Bahama 13 years ago. She's a photographer. She lived in a house that was just really hit hard by the storm surge, turned everything inside out. I mean, one of her walls blew out, no windows, everything in the house was just thrown all across the yard. And I pulled up to her in a car, and she was just on her, just sitting on the ground, just looking through stuff, trying to find anything that she could. That she could get. And
this is, you got a little bit of some sound from her. Here's something she was talking about.
We really have nothing. Nothing is left here for me. I'm trying to move and go somewhere.
Where are you?
I have no idea. If wherever God wants to take me, he could take me somewhere, anywhere, but not in the Bahamas.
She has family in Florida. She's trying to get to Florida?
She does want to get to Florida, but for her, as a she's not a Bahamian citizen, she would actually have to go first to Nassau to try to get a visa to travel to the U.S. because she's a citizen of Suriname. So it's a little bit more complicated. Yeah. And just to mention, there are a lot of immigrants in the Bahamas, especially Haitians. I did go to a neighborhood that was pretty hard hit by floods with Haitian immigrants, and a lot of them are undocumented in the Bahamas, and they basically, a lot of them do not have the option of trying to get off, at least to the U.S.
Yeah, how are people getting to the U.S.? I mean, what do you have to show? I'd imagine a visa.
we were just talking about how unclear that is right now. The criteria are just so murky.
I know. So how are they determining who gets on that boat?
So there's a couple ways. All right, I'm gonna tell you what I've been told, even though it's a little bit murky. So if you're a Bahamian citizen and you have a passport with a visa, you're fine. What is like kind of a wild card in this is that there's a bilateral agreement between the U.S. government and the Bahamas government that even if you don't have a visa, you can travel to the U.S. The trick is, you have to have a printout of your police records. Mm-hmm. And if your police records show you haven't had criminal convictions, it's kind of like a test of character is how they say it. Then you'll be granted access. The problem is, on the boat I was on, a lot of people came with their police records. There was a ferry from the Spanish company Balearia, which normally runs out of the port of Palm Beach to Freeport. Last night, a lot of people, over 100 were told, were taken off of that ferry because they were told that you have to have a visa at this point.
I mean, I'd imagine, you know, they tell us what we're supposed to keep with us in emergencies, but considering how devastating the storm was, I'm wondering how many people had their passports, and how are you getting your police record if the police department was flooded out?
Good question. Mm-hmm. One of the people I talked to in my story, she was actually on the ship. She's in West Palm Beach. I talked to her yesterday. She actually found her passport in her grass, she told me, after the storm, after the flood receded. She found her passport. If not for that, she would not be in West Palm Beach right now.
Yeah, I talked to one woman in that line who all of her belongings, everything she owned after this hurricane, was in a Ziploc bag. And one of them happened to be her passport that she was able to find. But like the people Danny spoke to, I spoke with people who just had that 1,000-mile stare in their eyes.
You know what? In the Bahamas, they have NEMA, which is the National Emergency Management Agency. It's their FEMA. Mm-hmm. But by what you just said a moment ago, I'm just wondering, what are they doing right now?
Well, again, they have scant resources, comparatively scant resources. They really cannot mobilize to the extent that we would expect from any country. What is supposed to supplement emergency management agencies like the one in the Bahamas is a broader regional emergency management agency known as the Caribbean Emergency Management Agency. And it also is not really that well stocked with resources, and it is having trouble mobilizing there as well.
Tim, this is surprising considering the Caribbean gets hit so frequently that they wouldn't be.
This is why, and this is something, again, that we're going to be discussing in the Latin American Caribbean report tomorrow, is with storms, with powerful storms like this now becoming the norm in the Caribbean rather than the exception during hurricane seasons, it is really going to be incumbent upon the United States and the international community to create a more coordinated relief effort. And that's going to include, for example, the kind of cruise ships that Danny and I went in on. Mm-hmm. They're the ones who can, as one Royal Caribbean, I was on a Royal Caribbean ship that diverted itself over to Freeport to deliver food and water. And one of their representatives told me, it says, we have a certain nimbleness that we can employ here to really supplement the relief operations that the governments and NGOs do. And I think he makes a good point.
We're not seeing the same thing that we saw after Maria when it hit Puerto Rico in that sense, right? I mean, it sounds like with the death toll keeps going up, it sounds like there's a count. They're keeping track of it, and they are, people, officials are telling us. I haven't heard any stories yet, though, about, like, getting supplies and that supplies are sitting on a dock. Really, what I'm hearing is anybody with a boat or plane is just going over there.
I'll address that for a second. There's a couple big differences between Puerto Rico and
proximity's one.
Proximity's a huge one. I mean, people are able on private vessels, private planes, to just get over there and get back on the same day. I mean, no problem. You could do it out of your backyard, some people, if they have a boat. The other thing is just topography. I mean, Puerto Rico has mountains. There's mountain towns that are very hard to reach. A road might have gone under in a mudslide. You can't access it. I mean, these islands in the Bahamas they're basically flat. Yeah. And nothing is hard to see from an airplane. From an airplane, you could basically see anything, and you could drop something in if you really had to, or take something out. So that's not as much of a geographical limitation in that way.
Yeah, my impression in Puerto Rico 2 years ago was the supplies were getting to the port in San Juan. The problem was getting them into the island. Right. And you're seeing somewhat the same thing with the Bahamas in the sense that, you know, maybe stuff's getting to Nassau, but then that's where the bottleneck seems to start in terms of a more coordinated way to get stuff from Nassau up to Grand Bahama and Abaco.
And as a reminder, too, again, the Bahamas are many islands. So, but do you tend to see people who just, they're trying to get to Florida more or other islands in the Bahamas?
To Florida. I think at this point, you're talking about people who just feel completely cut off from the world. And so to get to Florida right now is the brass ring for them. Mm-hmm. The big question, and this is something else we've been discussing this morning, the big question is whether the Trump administration is going to come through with and approve this request by politicians in Florida to grant Bahamians a visa waiver so that they really can come with just their passport and just proof that they are residents in the Bahamas. That's going to be a big factor. And right now, there is no guarantee. We can't take it for granted that the Trump administration is going to grant them that.
Talking again with WLRN's America's correspondent Tim Padgett. His Latin America report coming up tomorrow. We'll also, we've been talking with WLRN reporter Danny Rivero. If you didn't catch his story earlier today, it'll play again tonight on All Things Considered. You can also find it online at WLRN.org. A fascinating story about, again, that people trying to get out of the Bahamas, trying to get on a ship to come to Florida, and the chaos right now in just people looking for that opportunity, looking for something just to get out. An amazing story. Please check it out. Gentlemen, thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Lewis.
Thank you.
And again, we want to hear from you. If you have family, friends, property back in Grand Bahama or the Abacos, what's happening? What are you hearing? What's going on? Share your story. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundom. Still to come, how do we fix the affordable housing issues here in Miami? One group wants to hear from you on that. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, if you could do something about the lack of affordable housing in Miami-Dade, what would you do? Well, there's some folks who want to hear from you. The Florida International University Metropolitan Center is hosting a couple of open houses. They want to hear from you on this issue. The Metropolitan Center is a research group providing policy solutions. Joining us now is Dr. Ned Murray, Associate Director of the George M. Perez Metropolitan Center. Dr. Murray, thank you so much for the time today.
Good afternoon, Lewis.
When you look at Miami and South Florida and the housing situation here, what do you see as the primary concern for homeowners and renters?
Well, I think there are two primarily. The first, of course, is the rising housing cost. Our analysis in the planning document finds that 1,200 units for low and moderate income homeowners and renters are basically vanishing each year. And that trend's been going on now for about 5 years, and we expect it to continue. So there's 1,200 units that are basically off the market in terms of affordability for those homeowners and renters in those household income categories. The other issue which we found, and it's very concerning, particularly given your previous segment, is the age of the housing stock. So it's not just an affordability issue, it's a question of safe, decent, and affordable housing, as nearly 90%, 90,000 units within the city of Miami are now over 50 years old, which means that they probably don't meet code, certainly hurricane codes. So we have a real concern there relative to not only affordability, but safety and decent homes as well.
Let me come back to the first point you made, and I'm wondering, are developers knocking down those properties, or is just the value going up? The reason
It's appreciation mainly. There has been some demolition in certain neighborhoods within the city, but for the most part, these are values. These are owner values that are exceeding 250,000 now.
Yeah.
So we're losing those units under 250, and on the rental side, we're losing rental units that are priced at 1,000 or less.
So looking at the last statistic, about 70%. Of Miami households are renters, and then more than half of those are cost burden, meaning that you're talking about people who are spending more than a third of their income on their rent. What does a healthy statistic look like? What should it look like that you could say, okay, that's a healthy number for a city?
Well, that's a really good question, a good point, and something that we've noted in our study is, our numbers are always going to be much higher in terms of cost burden than other parts of the country because of that stubborn denominator we have, which is our local economy in terms of low wages and in service sector jobs. So if you look at it nationally, though, in terms of a city the size of Miami or greater, we should be somewhere in the 45% range. So we're far above that.
Wait, 45% renters?
Renters, right?
Okay.
So we're far above that, and it's just the scale as well, because when we're talking numbers like that, 61% cost burden renters, we're talking 74,000 households who wake up each month and have to figure out how to pay the rent and then figure out what's left of that, and what's even more disturbing is over the last few years we've seen a real growth in the amount of extremely or severely cost burden renter households. We now have 39,000 renters in the city of Miami who are now paying in excess of 50% of their income on housing costs. So this becomes a real kitchen table issue each month. Once again, renters are trying to figure out a way to pay that rent or that mortgage, and at the same time, it seems to be going up
and
on an annual basis.
How long can you have that many people living cost burden? Again, people spending at least a third, if not more than a third, I should say, on their rent. Are we approaching a cost bubble?
We really are. We've done studies in other parts of Florida, particularly the Keys, where we found that once the cost burden levels exceed 50% of income, people leave. It just becomes insurmountable because there's really nothing left at that point.
Is there any comparison to the 2008 housing bubble?
This is worse in many ways. That was a bubble, but we knew what was driving it. This market right now is essentially an investor's market. There is no market. Really for working families and individuals within the city of Miami, not for Miami-Dade County as a whole, that market doesn't exist. This is solely an external market that's being tapped into.
I'm talking with Dr. Ned Murray, Associate Director of the George M. Perez Metropolitan Center at FIU. They're hosting a series of open houses, and they're focused on this idea of affordable housing. And how do we solve this problem? You can find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Dr. Murray, as I said, you guys are having these open houses. You're looking for ideas, but what exactly are you looking for from people? What do you hope to hear?
Well, I think the most important thing we can do is to give the residents of Miami an opportunity to come to a venue where they can listen to what the city is proposing to do to address their issues, and to also receive some validation in terms of what they've been experiencing now for several years. As I said, this is a kitchen table issue. They're struggling. That no one needs to tell them, the residents of the city of Miami, that we have an affordable housing problem. They're dealing with it every month. So they need to be able to participate, engage city. NFIU will be there. We'll have an explainer video that'll be available to them that kind of makes some sense of the whole thing. Then we'll have tables set up with posters, and including posters that explain the planning and policy strategies that we're going to put forward. I mean, the city of Miami deserves a lot of credit for having floated a bond to begin to address that, and now we've come up with ideas in terms of how we can capitalize that bond and hopefully find the financing to create not only to create new housing, but to preserve what we have.
You know, I mean, part of it, that's the work you're doing with the city. This is separate, but I was wondering your take on this. I mean, last week there was a pretty tense meeting at the Miami-Dade County Commission on this issue of affordable housing, and they have a lot of money that should go towards this issue. People were asking, well, why isn't it being spent?
Well, it doesn't surprise me. We've been telling both the city and the county officials for some time now that the scope and scale of both the city and the county's affordable housing issue is really enormous. And there's, you could put all those funding pieces together and still not come close to addressing the unmet demand that exists. Now, obviously, there's ways we can better leverage those funds, and what we're asking the city of Miami to do is to use their capital, the $100 million forever bond, as seed capital for a much larger investment, because we're looking at something in the neighborhood of $4 to $6 billion in investment in affordable housing over the next 10 years that'll have to happen. So that's an enormous challenge, but I think the city of Miami is well positioned to do that. Unlike a lot of cities, the county's going to have to do something similar down the road, because when you get into at the county level, now you're looking at numbers that exceed 100,000 units that need to be assisted in some way. So it's a big challenge, and there is really no local government that can take this on their own with the loss of federal and state funding. But the challenge is to become creative at the local level and create these types of financing tools that are flexible, that enable local governments working with the private sector to be able to develop housing that's affordable, and but also, you know, to restore neighborhoods too where we're losing identity, and in the case of Miami, losing what we refer to as the soul of Miami, if we begin to lose the neighborhoods that we have in place right now.
And then this is an issue, obviously. I know we're talking about Miami. This is a South Florida issue, from Palm Beach County, Broward County, Monroe County, finding affordable housing. You said something interesting, though, there just now, is, again, what happens is we start to lose neighborhoods. We start to lose neighborhoods that have a lot of historic value to the community. These two open house meetings that you have are Little Havana and Little Haiti.
That's right.
You know, and these are the Little Haiti, especially, is you're talking about a community that's, you know, the word gentrification keeps popping up because its developers are now moving in there.
That's right. And you're talking a neighborhood where we have poverty rates that far exceed the cities and the counties as a whole, upwards of, you know, 30% people living in poverty. But these are working poor. These are people that work every day, yet still live in poverty. So, once again, we have this extreme on the denominator end, where we have such low incomes. The average household income for a renter in the city of Miami is about $33,000. So that doesn't get you a lot of housing in this market.
That gets you almost nothing.
That's right.
Let me finish with this, only because of time. I'm wondering how much of it is, look, this is just a popular place to live, and developers just, they see the opportunity. So they want to build. They want to build because there are buyers, whether they're coming from up north or they're coming from South America or any other part of the world. And also the fact that this is a very popular place for Airbnb. And we've heard from people in the Keys saying that's a problem for them. How big a role are these two things playing in this issue?
Well, it does. It does create a problem from the standpoint that you're taking units off the market that might be available for renters, particularly in neighborhoods or sections of the city where you have a high demand for housing. So we have certainly an issue there relative to not only Airbnb, but to the investor market overall, given the fact that the city of Miami has become, you know, one of those cities around the world that attracts investors, and that's the market that's being attended to. Whereas the working residents of the city of Miami are left out in the cold. So we need to begin to think about that. In fact, our number one priority working with the city, and I think the city officials agree with this, is keeping people in their homes. It's one thing in terms of building new housing, but we need to be able to preserve the housing for the people who are already here and in those very neighborhoods that you mentioned.
You know what?
Alpada, La Habana, places like that.
Dr. Murray, before I let you go real quickly, though, is this, you know, because we talked about the 2008 crisis, how do you see this one playing out? If we don't solve this, what happens?
Well, I guess the city becomes more and more of a resort community for the rich and famous, I guess. There seems to be no end in sight. At least back in the 2006-2007 bubble period, we did not see the intrusion into our neighborhoods. Most of the development was occurring in Brickell and in other higher priced submarkets of the city of Miami and in Miami-Dade in general. This is the first time that we've seen intrusion into the more established neighborhoods where our working residents and our precious residents do live.
Yeah.
And that's what's so disturbing. So that's going to continue because the land is becoming very scarce in the city, and the land costs are going up. So it's just a matter of time. We're seeing it already, as you mentioned, in
yeah.
Lady, but we're also seeing it in Little Havana and Alapata as well. So there's a lot of concern. It gets back to your point about neighborhoods. It's neighborhoods which make great cities, and right now those neighborhoods are under threat.
Dr. Ned Murray, Associate Director of the George M. Perez Metropolitan Center, again, Florida International University, hosting a series of open houses focused on this issue of affordable housing. You can find more information if you want to attend, learn more about it on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Dr. Murray, thank you so much for the time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, still to come, a new show playing in Homestead from a popular book of Cuba. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, becoming a professional baseball player is a dream for many young people, but that dream had held so much meaning and power for young Cubans admiring the sport during the 20th century. The book by Cuban author, American author, In Cuba, I Was a German Shepherd, explores the dream and desire in a beautiful detail. One of the short stories from the book was recently turned into a play. It's called Baseball Dreams. It's being performed this weekend at the Seminole Theater in Homestead. Madeline Marchant is the theater arts director at South Miami Middle School Center for the Arts and also an actress, and she plays the mother in the production. Madeline, great to have you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's great to be here, and thank you for supporting theater, live theater, which is so important.
We love to support the arts, absolutely. Also joining me is Gabriella do you know what, Gabriella? I was practicing it and I forgot it. Say it.
Betchtinger.
I got it. All right, thank you. Gabriella Betchtinger, seventh grader at South Miami Middle School. She is the daughter in the show. Great to have both of you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So much fun. Madeline, the production, again, this is a collection of short stories. This show is based on one of the short stories in there. Tell us about this book, the significance that it has, especially within the Cuban community.
Correct. This book, written by Ana Menendez, a short story, which the director, Philip Church, is one of those people that just takes anything that is art-related or story, and he turns it into a play, which is wonderful. So that's just another total different conversation. So this story, I think the main idea of the story is following your dream. And many times, you know, as a teacher myself, I know that I teach theater, so kids that come to me, you know, have the dream of being an actor or an actress. But it's so important just in life for any child, you know, whether a parent or anybody, just to support that dream. And what can happen if that dream is not pursued? You know, it can go, you know, awry. It could go totally different way. So Ana Menendez gives us this beautiful description of this child when he was younger, practicing and being bullied by kids, saying that you don't know how to throw a curveball and so forth. And he just really, really wanted to be a baseball player, you know. Unfortunately, because of all that he received, he never was able to fulfill his dream. And he did, you know, totally something else. And at the same time, the telling of this story with projections, with live music, with narration. So me and Gabby as actresses, at times we are speaking to each other as actors, then all of a sudden we stop talking. You hear my voice, narration, there's the screen. So there's so much going on. So it really brings the story to life.
You know? And this is about a mother and her daughter.
Well, the first part takes place in 1935.
Right.
And then the second part, 1965.
Right.
And we have a play. Well, we're meeting with her dad at the beach in Cuba. And, you know, it's explaining how beautiful the green palms and the blue Caribbean autumn. Just beautiful verbiage for describing this beautiful day, which is very special. And both of us, not only me as, you know, loving this person that we're hoping to wait. She's waiting for her father, who, you know, leaves us waiting the whole time.
Yeah.
You know?
Gabriella, you're the daughter.
Yes.
Tell us about her and your role in this show.
She is very, like, she's very, like, a little kid, so she always thinks of, like, the happy things and always wants to make her parents happy. And so I don't think she really realizes what's really going on until she's much older, as in the play. It does say that a part where her mom is smiling, but a fake smile, mm-hmm. that she doesn't really understand it until she grows, that she'll grow up, because she sees that fake smile a lot. And so she's kind of hoping that her dad comes, but I don't think she really realizes who he really is yet, because she's too, like, little. But she always likes to have, to make her mom very happy, because that's what she does most of the time.
Yeah.
And she also likes to play baseball. She wants to be,
Your character wants to play baseball.
Yeah.
But your character is a girl, and that's the challenge.
Yeah.
What's that like for you? I mean, you know, in preparing for the show. By the way, do you like baseball?
Yeah. I've seen a couple of the games. I went to, like, a game a long time ago, but that's basically it.
Yeah. But for your character, though, what is your character's dream?
To be a baseball player, I guess, because she does ask if girls can be baseball players. But I don't think she really knows, because she kind of wants to be like her dad, maybe.
Yeah. And you know what, Madeline, the tricky part always, too, in doing a production is taking a short story from a book and making it a show. This wasn't written as a stage performance. You took this story and made it. That's a challenge.
Correct, yeah. Philip Church, who's the professor of theater at FIU, who was my theater professor in college, and I sat there and enjoyed every single minute that this man taught us theater. So now, years later, I've been teaching theater already for 19 years, so now it's different. It's so nice to be directed by someone who I admired so much, but now it's different. It's very hard also as me as an actress and as a director to kind of just be there, like me and Gabby were talking about it, just be on the same plane. Like, she's an actress, we're an actress, we're both in a professional production. But Philip has this incredible magic to take stories that he sees and that call out to him, and that he, to put it into the, let's say, to the mind and to the eyes of the spectator. Not everybody likes to read. So if you imagine taking a classic, that's another wonderful idea. Imagine taking a classic, Wuthering Heights, that you don't want to read in school, but put it into a play,
right.
It's so much better. You know, so Philip has this wonderful, you know, talent to do that.
We bring in the actors because we want to get a taste of the show. You got a scene for us. Tell us a little bit about what this scene is.
Very short scene, yes. Short scene. So I bring some sandwiches to the beach as we're waiting, and we're watching two boys on the beach argue back and forth, and it's quiet. And this part here where I'm speaking, this is me live, okay, me speaking live, and her voice comes out of the voiceover, but right now she's going to be doing it live. So
okay.
She gets a little bit hungry, and she looks at the bag of sandwiches. So here we go. Mirta looked at the bag with the sandwiches. She'd had helped her mother make them, spreading mayonnaise on the sweet yellow bread, instructing her mother,
"No, the ham first, then the pork."
And her mother playing along. Her mother had been laughing and happy, and Mirta wanted to keep it that way, repeated.
No, the ham first, then the pork.
This time a little louder.
No, the ham first, then the pork. The ham and then the pork.
Until her mother had said, basta ya, and put an end to the game. And they kind of smiled, so it was like a game, but it was nice. So one little moment like that, that we have these little special moments as mother-daughter, and it's really awesome, cool to be able to do it with my student on a totally different way. So it's a beautiful story, a lot of projections. Behind us, three projections, live yeah. musicians. It's really an interesting, captivating story to just pretty much sit back. And it's almost like when you're driving and hearing a book on, you know, a book on tape.
An audiobook, yeah.
This is exactly it, but there's so much going on. So,
again, I'm talking with Madeleine Marchand and Gabriella Bechtinger. Both of them are in the production called Baseball Dreams. This story is a short story in a collection called In Cuba, I Was a German Shepherd. It's by the Cuban-American author Ana Menendez. And the play by What If Works will be performed September 13th and 14th at the Seminole Theater in Homestead. We'll have that up on our social media, too, if you want to find more information. So Gabriella, you're one of her students.
Yes, I am.
So what's it like? You're working with your teacher. I don't know. That's kind of, I might be a little nervous.
No.
I would get nervous.
It's a cool and different experience because usually she's the one directing us and telling us our notes and stuff. But when we have Philip doing it, it's kind of like you see that she's also an actor and then that it always like circles around. And so it's cool to see. And then we're on the same level. We're both actresses in a professional way. So it's cool. We're all like work together.
is this your first professional
yeah.
show?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Not to say you don't seem nervous. You seem very confident.
I guess.
You got this covered, right? You want to be an actress.
Yes.
How'd you get into acting though?
Well, my cousin he went through her program too, and I saw one of his shows, and I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. So and then I went to the same theater company as him, and then I've been practicing there, and then I auditioned for her, and I got in, and then I kept on practicing.
And here you are getting ready for your first show, which, by the way, the Seminole Theater.
Beautiful.
There's a unique story behind this. I mean, this is one of the oldest theaters in South Florida. It has gone through all kinds of iterations.
Yes.
Almost totally destroyed by Hurricane Andrew.
Absolutely.
Rebuilt, and now it's a really wonderful space. It's also a pretty big space, though, for something like this. I mean, how are you working?
Actually, we're glad because we have three huge projections. Think of three, you know, half a movie screen, three yeah. of them in the back. So that's important that we do have that space. So right now when we're rehearsing, we look like the little people. But once they put those projections behind us, we are totally lost. And there's so much going on. So if I mention the word and the palm, the green palms fading in the distance, like, you know, blue, white, like the sky, you're going to see the palms. You're going to hear water. It's like just really... But almost like this interactive, without you moving from your seat, you're feeling and you're really sensing everything that they had back here in Cuba. And it, you know, talks about the revolution. There's just so much going on.
I almost wonder at times, and because you're her teacher, but mm-hmm. now you're playing mother-daughter.
Yeah.
It seems kind of you can jump into it because it's almost a nurturing sort of setup, right?
True, but it's yes. funny. At times, I'll say things as mom, you know, like I'll be like, hey, you know, I'll say a note as a mom, like, which I, you know, I can because I'm not in front of my director. And then, of course, sometimes I want to, you know, say something as a director to my, you know, to my students. So, but like she said, it's just kind of nice for once just not having to do the work and then somebody tell me what to do. And it's been great, you know, to be able to work with Philip. Another one of my colleagues is in part one. She's also a theater teacher for Dade County. So it's just really nice that all these Dade County public school students are performing in these shows. And FIU and What If Works does really try to keep the theater alive by taking pieces of work and make them magic.
Gabriella, I'll give you the last word. What do you want people to take away from this show?
I want them to take away the feeling and the when you learn something.
What, when you learn something?
Yeah, when you
learn. Lesson.
A lesson,
okay.
Of that, when you need to pursue your dreams, no matter what anyone says to you, if they say that you can't or that you shouldn't, you should at least try. And if you get there, then you get there and you're at least you have your dream. So I feel like you should always pursue your dream no matter what anybody tells you. That's what you should learn.
That's a great
this.
Lesson. I like that lesson. Gabriella, and I said, did I say it right? Gabriella Becht, say it.
Gabriella Bechtinger.
Bechtinger. See, I have to learn. I have
I'm
to practice. Madeline Marchand, and they're both in this show. It's a fabulous show. Check it out at the Theater Arts Director. I should say Madeline is the Theater Arts Director at South Miami Middle School Center for the Arts, and they're both in this show called Baseball Dreams, again, playing at the Seminole Theater. We'll have more information on our social media. Break a leg, guys.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. That's our program for this Monday, September 9th. Coming up tomorrow on the program, what policies do airports and TSA agents have for screening transgender passengers? A new investigation from the Miami Herald and ProPublica found the systems in place are forcing many people into very uncomfortable situations. Plus, we're going to look into the science behind categorizing hurricanes. There's only up to Category 5, but Dorian has gotten some people thinking maybe there should be a Category 6. And finally, the new music director from the Palm Beach Symphony is coming to the Frost School of Music to make his conducting debut. He's a new member of the faculty taking part in the Frost Music Live series, and we'll meet him tomorrow. All of that coming up on the show. Remember to find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Always let us know what you think. And don't forget, if you missed the show, catch the rebroadcast at 8. If not, find us on iTunes, subscribe, let us know what you think of the podcast. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.